You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, Sweden's defence chief says that its navy is still trying to verify reports that a Russian submarine is off the coast of Stockholm.
We can't draw any conclusions so far. It is a suspicion of foreign underwater activity. We haven't been able to confirm this, and if so, which country would engage in such activities?
Alessio Patilano from King's College and Zenia Wickett from Chatham House weigh in on the suspicious activity in the Baltic Sea. Then we check in on the US midterm elections as President Obama casts his ballot in an advanced poll. It's unclear if voters will follow his lead and stick with the Democrats, or if the Senate will go to the Republicans. And we'll catch up with Monocle's Marcus Hippie as the Monocle book tour hit Sydney.
The book signing was an absolute success. When Tyler came to the bookshop and sat down to sign books, it took about an hour and a half for him to finish that job. So that gives you an idea of how many people there were actually there for the book signing.
He should get his speed up, shouldn't he? All that, plus we remember the life of Oscar de la Renta, and we also hear about an unusual art gallery in Nigeria. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So plenty to come in the next hour on Midori House, but before any of that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. South African athlete Oscar Pistorius has begun serving time in jail for killing his girlfriend, Reeva Steenkamp. He was driven to Pretoria's Kgosi Mampuru prison after Judge Thokozile Masipa gave him a five-year jail sentence for culpable homicide, but cleared him of murder. Pretoria's defence team say they expect him to serve 10 months, with the remainder under house arrest. His family say he will not appeal. These Pretoria residents have mixed views about the sentence.
Judge Masipa was too lenient towards this case because if you check the case as a whole, most people were expecting at least 10 years to 15 years.
You can break him inside there. There's a lot of gangsters and stuff. 6 months in prison can... It's another life that anybody doesn't know about when you're on the streets.
He killed somebody, not what? Looking at in an eye of the law, I think it is fair.
Russian investigators say criminal negligence was behind the crash at Moscow's Vnukovo International Airport that resulted in the death of Total's chief executive. Christophe de Margerie died along with three crew members when his private jet collided with a snowplow. Investigators say the snowplow's driver was drunk and that negligent managers at the airport had failed to coordinate the actions of their employees. The Federal Investigations Committee of Russia, which answers to President Putin, is investigating the crash. Human Rights Watch says it has strong evidence Ukraine attacked populated areas of Donetsk with cluster bombs, banned by many other states. HRW is accusing the Ukrainian army of using the weapon, which scatters bomblets, to shell the rebel-held eastern city earlier this month. Ukraine did not sign up to the 2008 global treaty banning cluster bombs, but a Ukrainian security spokesman said Ukraine did not use banned weapons or shell civilian areas. One of two Canadian soldiers hit by a car in an apparent terrorist attack in Quebec has died of his injuries. Officials say the soldier, whose name has not been released, died early on Tuesday. The suspected attacker, who officials said had become influenced by radical Islam, has been shot and killed. The attack was the first such incident in Canada since the country joined the fight against Islamic State militants. The World Health Organization says tens of thousands of people in West Africa are to begin receiving experimental Ebola vaccines from January. But the WHO is warning that mass immunization is still far off. Clinical trials of the GlaxoSmithKline and NewLink Genetics vaccines have begun, with 500 volunteers due to take part in countries including the United States, Britain, Germany, Switzerland, Mali, Gabon and Kenya. Talks between the organisers of Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement and representatives of the territory's government have ended without agreement. The discussions aimed at resolving the current stalemate, which had been called off last week, were held at a neutral location in Aberdeen on the southern side of Hong Kong Island. The government has refused to meet protesters' demands that they be allowed full voting rights to choose the next leader of the territory in 2017. Alex Chow, General Secretary of the Hong Kong Federation of Students, is disappointed nothing came from the meeting.
It is kind of a peaceful meeting, and the aim of the Federation, why we are here today, is to bring the views of Hong Kong people, the protesters, to those officials from the government, to let them really understand the political demand of Hong Kong people, to endorse civil nomination and to restructure the Legislative Council, especially the functional group, to eliminate all the functional group. But so far, we could not hear concrete proposal from the government.
Italian police have uncovered a fraud which they say has cost Italian taxpayers 1.7 billion euros. Two businessmen are being accused of setting up the scheme, which used false invoices to bill the state for non-existent security, cleaning and other services. Police say the fraud, which dates back to 2001, involved 62 people. Altogether, they've seized goods worth 100 million euros related to the crime, including 100 properties and two firms. 70 police officers raided a number of properties in the early hours of the morning in Lazio, Lombardy, Piedmont, Veneto and Sardinia. That's the latest news. I'm Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monocle 24。Op
London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18:07, which means it's 13:07 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Alessio Patilano from the Department of War Studies at King's College and Xenia Wickett, US Project Director at Chatham House. Welcome both to the programme. We'll start with the conflict in the Ukraine. A report released by Human Rights Watch says that the Ukrainian army appears to have fired cluster bombs, a weapon banned in much of the world, on several occasions in the heart of Donetsk on October the 2nd and also October the 5th. The two October strikes occurred nearly a month after Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko and rebel representatives signed a ceasefire agreement. Meanwhile, there's a curious interview circulating the internet from a former Polish foreign minister, Radoslaw Sikorski. He told the website Politico in 2008, Putin wanted us to become participants in the partition of Ukraine. Well, Sikorski has since said the interview was overinterpreted. Well, to help us interpretate that and much more, I'll now turn to our guest. Alessio, first of all, what do we make of this cluster bomb story? You know, it's one of these tales, you know, we like to think of the good and the bad when we report on the war. But it seems that both sides have turned to rather kind of murky tactics.
Well, definitely the reports we're reading, they're coming from very reliable sources. So the first thing to acknowledge is that the claims that this happened actually have very substantial basis. So there's nothing to suggest that that's not the case. And again, I suppose that once that is clarified, then the next point to make is that what we're looking at is two sides in military terms. We're looking at two sides drawing upon similar set of capabilities, similar sort of basis. Basic training, basic understanding of how to operate in those type of conditions. So even though there is a sense that has been created precisely because of the political circumstances of the situation whereby the Ukrainian governmental forces are the good guys, as it were, in trying to reestablish control, when it comes down to the military aspects of it, they both draw upon sort of former Soviet era type of material, equipment and capabilities. So it is not entirely surprising that actually when faced to the facts on the ground and the difficulty to operate against the rebel-held cities, they're going back to this type of ammunition.
And just tell me before I bring in Xenia, cluster bombs, have been banned by most countries, or that Ukraine Absolutely. Is not a signatory to this?
No, it isn't. No, it isn't. Nor is a thing Russia and the Soviet Union before it, nor is the United States. So they're banned from most countries, but Ukraine is not part, is not signatory to the agreements. Therefore, in that respect, there is nothing really illegal to the terms of their own normative framework going on in there.
Zenia, I want to bring you in this really intriguing interview that surfaced with the former foreign minister who just stepped down in September, Sikorsky. He says that there was a discussion when they went to Moscow where President Putin suggested that Ukraine wasn't a real country, that it was a made-up country, and that half of it really kind of belonged to Poland. So why didn't Poland take half and they would take the other half? And in fact, in the past few months, other Russians have suggested that the country should be divvied up between the Hungarians and the Poles and the Romanians and the Russians. Do you think we give credibility to this story?
I mean, this is not the first time that, you know, similar allegations. I remember vividly I was living in Switzerland about 4 or 5 years ago when Gaddafi was still around, and he wrote to the UN Secretary General and said, why don't we divvy up Switzerland? It's not a real country. You know, give the Italian part back to Italy, the German part back to Germany, and the French part back to France. You can imagine the Swiss response to that. But you do have to remember that for some individuals, these borders aren't real borders. Mm. And so the idea that you actually have a state that's really only decades old in some cases is kind of farcical. So you can see how some people think in these terms, and you can see why some people think this is very personal. You look at the Crimea, there are an awful lot of people who say, well, you know what, there's more, you know, and this has been Putin's argument all along, has been, there's so many Russian speakers, they're really Russian, we need to protect Russians, you know, ethnic Russians, so therefore we need to go in and protect Crimea. So on the one hand, I can quite imagine him saying this. It's said a little bit more bluntly, according to the news report, and Sikorsky has said, yeah, it's not quite how it played out. But it's said a little bit more bluntly than you might imagine. But if you use different language, this is not so dissimilar from Putin's public comments that he made, saying, you know what, we have a responsibility to go into Crimea because there are Russians in Crimea. He could just as easily, and in fact he has said similar things, and his government has said similar things, there are, you know, huge Russian populations in eastern Ukraine, so therefore we need to go and protect them. That's what makes so many in the Baltics nervous, because there are huge Russian-speaking populations in the Baltics and elsewhere, and they are nervous that Putin's going to use that as an excuse. So at some level, you know, I would be surprised if he was quite that blunt, but it's not so dissimilar from what he said publicly previously. So, you know, you can imagine that there was an intimation.
I also find it fascinating that underlying actually lots of contemporary politics and, you know, what nations think of each other in Europe, old empires are still there. You know, what the Hungarians used to have, you know, the Lithuanians are nervous of the Poles. There's lots of strange tensions still run very deep, especially in Eastern Europe.
Absolutely. I think that we have always to keep in the back of our minds that this is something that really is at the heart of Putin's sort of the way he's been presenting himself, the way he's been shaping up as the role of Russia in Eastern Europe. This is very much about that Russian influence all over that area. And I think in a broader sense, the bigger political game here that is being played out, and I think all the various stories that we're reading over the past few weeks, even the one that we're going to be talking in a moment about, the Swedish chasing a possible Russian submarine. This is all connected in the sense that this is part of this divide and rule approach, right? Divide and create a tension across this broader area where there's small states that are a composition, a patchwork of different identities that plays very much the strength of this approach. Like, yes, guys, but, you know, remember, you all used to be part of this bigger Russian empire, and we back here precisely to tell you that we're here to protect that kind of tradition and that kind of legacy.
And we have to remember, you know, relatively speaking, sitting here in the UK, we have relatively short memories. Mm. If you sit in the United States, you have an even shorter memory. You're very good at looking forward at you know, what allegiances, what allies, what partnerships you need in the future. You're not terribly good, and this is in some respects a very positive thing, at looking backwards, but it means you miss an awful lot of lessons. In Asia, incredibly good at looking backwards. you know, and they have much longer time horizons. There are parts of Europe where they have very, very long memories, far more Asian than they are American, kind of Western style. That's not changing anytime soon. And our inability to remember that and understand that means that we do have a tendency to put our foot in places where maybe it's misunderstood.
Well, we'll keep with President Putin and what he may or may not be up to, because it's become one of the biggest naval operations the Swedish military has ever undertaken since the end of the Cold War. Both Russian and Swedish officials won't confirm whether or not a Russian submarine has made a distress call off the coast of Stockholm. The hunt for the suspected submarine has sparked many questions. The Latvian Foreign Minister, Edgars Rinkevics, tweeted, "Closely following events in the Swedish territorial waters may become a game changer for the security of the whole Baltic Sea region." Do you think that is true, Zenia?
Yes, but it's mostly going to be due to perceptions. I mean, given what we've seen from Russia over the last year, the Baltics are extremely nervous that Russia is going to do to them what he's done to Crimea, what he did to Georgia some years ago. And so they are exceptionally sensitive to what they perceive to be Russian encroachment on in their area of responsibility, if you will. So if this turns out to be true, yes, I think it will change very much the volume and urgency of what we're hearing from the Baltics. And that will push NATO member states perhaps to take a more kind of assertive action within the NATO structure, which would mean it wouldn't be necessarily stationing NATO troops in partnership countries, but it certainly would be, you know, doing much more training, rotating troops in and out and things of that nature, perhaps. On the other hand, you do have to remember that as long as they're actually out of, and I don't know, we haven't been told exactly where this sub is allegedly sitting, as long as they're actually out of Swedish waters, this is actually quite legitimate to have an intelligence operation against another country. So we may not like it, but again, I don't know actually where the waters are, and I don't think we've been told.
Alessia, if it was an attempt to kind of tweak the tail of the Swedes, it's kind of failed miserably, because what's happened is, you know, the Swedes have been quite aggressive for Sweden. They've declared a no-fly zone. They've told ships they can't come within 6 miles of their search vessels. They've also tried to get the Swedish media off their tail by kind of giving false stories of where they kind of spotted this submarine. It's kind of woken up the whole region a little bit.
It is, but at the same time, I think it's the appropriate response. This is the sort of situation whereby the Russian game is pretty clear. I think if they wanted really to mount serious military operations again in the Baltic, you would have seen a slightly different type of setup, and you would have seen a different type of movement in the area. Here, what we are looking at is a situation of harassing, literally, countries that are borderlines. These are border states, right? The states that are in the part, you know, Sweden is in the European Union, but it's not part of NATO. So there is no clear mechanism in terms of military action. What happened? What do we do if something happens in the Baltic with these states? There is nothing sufficiently clear. So the tactic there is to create sufficient harassment. And this is the submarine, whether this is submarine or not, this is to be established. But just a few weeks back, we had the incursions of jets into, I think it was Norwegian airspace. So there has been cases of Russian behavior that clearly suggest they're trying to test the waters, to test the boundaries of our reaction. So I think what the Swedes are doing is actually spot on. They have military capabilities that are perfectly tailored for a littoral type of operations. They deployed all their assets, they deployed massively, and the signal they're sending, we're not here to be bullied, we're not here to be harassed as you've done in other places, precisely because of what we've seen happening in Crimea, and precisely because they know they are on a borderline, and if they don't take the first step, it will be a really sort of invitation, if you want, to the Russian to step up and create again this divide and rule type of attitude.
Well, we're going to keep with the idea of spies and spying in a moment, because we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and Alessio Patilano and Zenia Wickett. When we return, we're going to be looking at the latest developments out of Kobani.
The UN Security Council is the roundtable heart of diplomacy that decides when to act on some of the globe's most pressing issues. But is it fit for purpose? Monocle's Steve Bloomfield paid a visit to its HQ to find out.
We blame it, we ridicule it, we say those two letters with our eyes rolled, yet we don't really understand it. We don't really stop to think why it struggles to reach an agreement. The clue is in the name, the United Nations. Since when were our nations united? And if they ever had been, would a body such as this ever need to exist?
Safe and Sound, a photographic essay now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Alessio Patilano and Zenya Wickett. Iranian broadcaster Press TV claims suspicious circumstances surround the death of its Turkey correspondent, Serena Shim. Shim died in a car accident Sunday while returning to her hotel room in Turkey from Kobani. The day before, she filed a report on the Iranian English language station in which she claimed the Turkish intelligence agency had threatened her and accused her of spying. Still, fighting continues in the Syrian-Turkey border town as Kurdish Peshmerga forces from northern Iraq cross through Turkey's territory to help defend the besieged town. Today, British officials announced it is authorising spy planes and armed drones to perform surveillance missions over Syria. Alessio, how important are these little incremental steps we're seeing every day? We saw yesterday the Turks say that they would, as we said, allow Iraqi Kurdish forces to cross via their border into Kobani. We've seen pictures today of kind of the real destruction of that city, that, you know, building after building taken out by air attacks. Now the Brits coming in saying they're going to give armed drones and spy planes. Where are we heading?
I think at the moment is I suppose that the important thing to say is that there is a clear sense of direction. The good of action has to be taken. I think, however, that there is very little political capital and military capabilities available to conduct the scale of operations that would be necessary to actually tackle this issue. And it's one of those problems that is cross borders in an area that has been in trouble for a very long time. And as a result of that, it's very difficult to judge the extent to which launching a campaign over the Syrian-Turkish border or over the Iraqi-Syrian border would actually contribute to a result without creating troubles or just shifting the problem from one border to another. So unfortunately, all these steps, these are small steps and incremental steps, because people are trying to sort of test out the extent to which you might achieve a degree of effect. The important point to make, on the other hand, is also that purely air campaigns, or sort of campaigns centered purely on air power with very limited intervention on land, are bound not to achieve full success, because unless you put boots on the ground. And, you know, the narrative of, let's allow the locals to take charge of that. I think that's a half-baked truth, in the sense that, yes, sure, if they were capable and if they have sort of the necessary capabilities and covering the whole spectrum to cut the substantial operations, yes, why not? But I think anything short of that is just, as I said, a clear signal of a willingness to do something, but at the same time, an acknowledgement of the limitations of their political willingness to go all the way.
Is there any strategy here, or?
I think one of the interesting things for me watching this is, you know, you'll remember just a few days ago, it may have been a week ago, the Americans said Kobani is not a strategic importance, and yet, you know, a few days later, they are airlifting military arms to the Kurds in Kobani. They are enthusiastically supporting and pressuring the Turks to open the border so that more forces can cross, although clearly not PKK-affiliated forces, but others. And what's interesting to me from this is that, you know, their original statement, and this is, you know, that this is not of strategic value or strategic importance, is very true, but they have recognized that this has become a kind of something that everybody is watching. This has become a moment that if IS take over Kobani. That has huge implications for the Kurds, that has potential implications for the Turks, that has huge positive implications for IS, and they will use that. It's almost as though we're getting a little bit more media savvy and recognizing that there are not just battles to be won, but there are media battles to be won. And so that this is actually suddenly very important. And I think that's an interesting transition that's taking place, and frankly, about time that it's taking place. But I will caveat that with, you know, picking up from what Alessio said, is that the West is trying to keep a really uncomfortable line, a very difficult line, between recognizing that they don't want IS to take over Iraq and or Syria, but also recognizing that there are limitations to what they can do, both in real terms, but also in political terms, in terms of public support. And they're struggling with finding that line. And the reality is that line keeps moving.
Well, we're going to now go to our final subject for today. This is a high-stakes battle on at the moment in the US for control of the Senate as midterm elections loom. Right now, Democrats control the upper chamber of Congress, but Republicans are making strong inroads. And if they win, we'll end up having control over both the Senate and the House of Representatives. President Barack Obama isn't necessarily helping the situation on the campaign trail, as Gallup's daily tracking poll has his popularity sitting around 40%. Now, Zenia, I know this is a topic that you know very well. First of all, for people who are not American, why are the midterms important? Why should we be following what's happening?
The midterms are important for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, this is, you know, you can't equate it to House of Lords, House of Commons. But unlike the British system, there are three parts of the US government that together govern. There's the presidency, the administration, there's Congress, and there's the judiciary. And Congress has huge influence to pass things, to not pass things, to move things forward, to question things. If the Republicans take over the Senate, which is the upper house effectively, if the Republicans take over that, then I guarantee the next 2 years are going to be even more stymied. There's going to be even more political partisanship. The only work that will be done in Congress will be moving for, and I hasten to add, this is not just because of the Republicans' fault, this is also the Democrats' fault, so I'm not being partisan here, but the only work that will take place in Congress is questioning of the healthcare law, you know, Obamacare, questioning of Benghazi, particularly if Hillary Clinton runs. We're not going to get any work done at all, and so you're going to essentially, if there is this change, there is this turnover, you are going to get an equally stymied situation. If there isn't a turnover, you're still going to have the current political polarization. So in some respects, the policy progress is going to be changed very little. Where it really then starts to matter is in two areas. One area, practically speaking, is the Senate confirms senior leadership positions in the administration. And so if the Senate is Republican, none of that is going to happen. So all of the senior leadership in Obama administration, the gaps will remain gaps. The second thing is that this matters for the 2016 presidential election. Whatever happens now, if the Republicans do take the Senate, you've got the Republicans holding the Senate and the House and Congress. And then the public is going to expect them to get something done. And if nothing happens, they're going to get a lot more blame than they would do if it were as it currently is, which split between the Republicans and Democrats. So this is actually quite important, but I anticipate in real terms, day to day, you're not going to see much more progress.
Alessio, we haven't got much time left, but just, are you surprised at how toxic, you know, brand Obama is? You know, the strange thing is he's one of those politicians who, on the international stage, quite liked actually abroad, but at home, my gosh.
Well, I think that it comes down to the expectation. He raised the bar. He put the bar very high when he came into power because he had a very ambitious agenda. He was presented, that he presented himself as someone that wanted to deliver, particularly to the American people. And this was something that pretty much everybody from the outside of the United States liked about him, because it connected also to what would have happened by association in American foreign security policy. So there was this huge expectation. And I think at the moment what is happening is that Americans don't feel that the expectations have been fully met. And interestingly enough, even foreign opinion is changing. I mean, if you go in Asia these days and you talk to, you know, politicians and policymakers in the area, they're all extremely worried and anxious about this midterm election and about to the future of American policies, precisely because of certain steps taken during the Obama administration that weren't necessarily followed up with a practical initiative for the reasons that Xenia mentioned about how stifling the politics in the US at the moment are.
Well, I'd like to have quizzed you both more on that subject and many others, but Alessio Patalano and Xenia Wickett, I'm really sorry, but we're going to have to leave it there. But thank you for joining us on Midori House. And Alessio is, of course, from the Department of War Studies at King's College, and Xenia Wickett is the US Project Director at Chatham House, and both regular voices here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tóquio.
London, New York, Tóquio. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, lots to still come in the second half of today's show. We're going to go to Sydney and hear what life is like on the road with Marcus Hippie as our book tour around the world continues. But before we get started on that, here's Bill Bingham with the world news headlines.
South African athlete Oscar Pistorius has begun serving time in jail for killing his girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp. Pistorius' defence team say they expect him to serve 10 months with the remainder under house arrest. His family say he will not appeal. Russian investigators say criminal negligence was behind the crash at Moscow's Vnukovo International Airport that resulted in the death of Total's chief executive. Christoph de Margerie died along with three crew members when his private jet collided with a snowplow. Human Rights Watch says it has strong evidence Ukraine attacked populated areas of Donetsk with cluster bombs, banned by many other states. HRW is accusing the Ukrainian army of using the weapon, which scatters bomblets, to shell the rebel-held eastern city earlier this month. One of two Canadian soldiers hit by a car in an apparent terrorist attack in Quebec has died of his injuries. Officials say the soldier, whose name has not been released, died early on Tuesday. The suspected attacker, who officials said had become influenced by radical Islam, had been shot and killed. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill. And welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time here in London is 18.32, 21.32 in Moscow, and it's 4.32 Wednesday morning in Sydney. And that's where we're off to next. Don't worry, I haven't got him out of his little bed. Monocle staff are on the road right now as part of our book tour. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is on shelves around the world now. But we decided to check in with the Australian leg of the tour. And earlier, I spoke with Monocle's Marcus Hippie, normally here on Monocle 24, presenting the menu amongst many other things, who's in Sydney, to try and get some first impressions from him.
Yeah, it was the first book signing today, actually, Andrew, and it's my first time in Australia. I don't know if I've ever told you. That's actually, like, for some reason, I've never made it all the way here. And we had the first book signing today for me. It was at Kinokuniya Bookstore here in Sydney, which is actually the biggest bookshop in Australia, and it's absolutely massive. It's in this shopping centre, and, well, it's definitely one of the biggest bookshops I've been to in my life. And the book signing was an absolute success. I think we had about... Well, basically, when Tyler came to the bookshop and sat down to sign books, it took about an hour and a half for him to finish that job. So that gives you an idea of how many people there were actually there for the book signing.
He's going to have a very sore wrist by the time he gets back to London.
Exactly. It's going to be busy because this is going to continue. It's not just about Sydney. We're going to Brisbane tomorrow. There's going to be another book signing there tomorrow. There's also going to be an actual party in the evening. And to those listeners who are at the moment wondering where that's going to take place, I can tell you that it's at a place called Scrumptious Reads, which is in James Street shopping precinct. And that's the place where there's been a Monocle pop-up for a while as well. And one more party coming up during this tour in Australasia. On Friday evening, we're going to be in Auckland, and there's going to be one more book signing taking place, and a party actually taking place there as well on Friday.
So if you want to get, if you want to get your copy of the Monocle Guide to Good Business, you can go along to any of those events. Tyler will be there. Marcus Hippie is going to be there. Emily from our PR team, she's accompanying them as well. But Marcus, tell me, so your first time in Australia, what's your first impressions?
It's been absolutely amazing. I feel like people have been hiding something from me. No one's been telling me about the greatness of Australia. You know, when my friends have gone to Australia, they've always returned with photos of them hugging koalas. You know, that's the cliched photo. You go to this zoo in Sydney, you find koalas, and yeah, you just spend some time with them and send the photos to your friends. But actually, a great climate. I've been surprised by... obviously, I know my stuff about food and drink, but I didn't realize how good the coffee is over here. And I think it's just amazing that when you are walking on the streets of Sydney, you don't get that many coffee chains. You don't see that many Starbucks over here. There's not that many Pret a Manger's over here. It's all about independent coffee shops and about great coffee. I had my first Australian cup of coffee at Sydney Airport. And do you know what kind of coffee you get when you go to an airport in the UK or
not
in the
good.
US? It's not great. But actually, it was amazing over here. Absolutely amazing. So Australia is a tough market if you belong to a chain and you want to kind of bring your stuff to this country. Another thing is that people are just really good looking. I went to Bondi Beach on Sunday, and I guess it's about climate. I guess it's about, you know, that, you know, when you've got water around you, kind of find yourself maybe wearing slightly less clothes. But people are really good looking over here, and I feel like there's a massive kind of trend of taking care of yourself and doing physical exercise and outdoors and stuff. That's something we don't really have that much in London.
No, it's that kind of culture of kind of sport and fitness is pretty amazing. So did you pull on your budgie smugglers when you were down on Bondi Beach?
You know, it's been tough. Like, I've already decided I have to come back to Australia sometime very soon. Because unfortunately, the airline company I flew with lost my luggage, which meant that I only got back my swimming trunks and Speedos last night when it was getting already quite cold. So I've missed my chance this time, but hopefully I will have time to actually come back to Australia soon.
You weren't doing the kind of Finnish all naked thing, were you, on Bondi Beach?
You know, I've learned it by heart by now that I can't do my Finnish all naked stuff in many other countries. You kind of have to be careful about where you decide to do that, Andrew.
Well, I think everyone should come along and meet Marcus Hippie. Marcus, thank you so much for joining us. Marcus, of course, a producer here on Monocle 24 and also the presenter of The Menu, our food and drink show, and also somebody who looks good in budgie smugglers.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. A pop-up contemporary art gallery in Port Harcourt, Nigeria, occupies a space that is very close to artist and filmmaker Zena Sarawiwa. The Boys' Quarters project space is situated in the building where her father, the activist and Nobel Peace Prize nominee Ken Sarawiwa, had his office before he was executed under the military regime of Sani Abacha in 1995. The art space will be open for the next 2 years to showcase the lives and the struggles of people living in the Niger Delta. Zena is curating the exhibition and she joins us in the studio now. Thank you very much for coming to this. Now, I've looked at the space. Perhaps you could explain to people, first of all, what the boys' quarters means.
Sure. So Boys Quarters is the name I've given my gallery. So it's a gallery that's going to have multiple exhibitions. But the Boys Quarters, I think, really refers to, it's a colonial term, and it refers to the servants' quarters in West Africa and I think other parts of Africa as well. So I mean, it's totally politically incorrect in terms of the servants, you know, who may or may not be men and women referred to as boys. And so it's the Boys Quarters, which is like the servants' housing, which is often on the properties of people, you know, who have money, and that's where they used to live. So my thing is that in Nigeria, you know, the idea in Nigeria is about trying to transcend and escape the boys' quarters and to be in the big house. Obviously, everyone wants to be the big house, the big man. But for me, I feel that the boys' quarters occupies a really interesting and special place in that we need to run towards the boys' quarters to get a sense of understanding who we are. So in a sense, what I wanted to do was to have a gallery that exalted that sort of forgotten and that area of Nigerian life that people wanted to run away from. And it's also a democratic statement, in a sense, saying that everybody is important in Nigeria, not just about those with money. And it's about, you know, valuing every strata of society within the country.
And for you, is this a pulling together of some of the strands of your life? You know, you're an artist yourself. This is a space that you're curating, but it has obviously an amazing connection to your dad. Mm. Is this a way of, you know, of kind of honouring the things that he did as well?
There's certainly a lot of that in there, for sure. I think really my main interest was trying to reimagine the Niger Delta. So if you went and Google image Niger Delta, there's some very sort of harrowing images that come up, and it becomes a sort of place that you're very fearful of. It's highly politicized, understandably, considering the history. And for me, though, I felt that, you know, it's coming up to the 20th anniversary of my father's death next year, and it feels really important to sort of reimagine the Niger Delta and think about it in a new way. We're coming up to a moment where, you know, perhaps it's going to be a post-oil region. I think the whole world has to think about what's going to happen when oil runs out. And in a sense, I feel that the Niger Delta, our relationship with the environment, is something that I really wanted to explore. So where my father comes into it is that I think his more political and environmental legacy has been explored a bit, but the cultural side hasn't. And I think the cultural angle is so important when we're trying to sort of redefine, reimagine and transcend a political past. So for me, it's about putting culture first and using art as a way to start to negotiate our own ideas about what it means to live in the Niger Delta, and also our own ideas about the relationship between self and environment.
Now, the Niger Delta, you know, your work, your father's work has put the spotlight on the kind of terrible environmental impact of what's happened to communities there, of the battles between the oil companies and the locals. Just tell us today, what's happening in the Niger Delta? Is there an uneasy calm at the moment?
Is there an uneasy calm? I mean, there's so much. I mean, it's large and there's many different things going on in different areas. I think there's still calls for big companies to clean up oil spillages. There's also what we call artisanal refining, where, you know, ordinary people, especially villagers, have gone and they've set up their own refineries. So there's that issue as well, which is, you know, apparently causing problems too. I've heard that there's some oil companies, big oil companies that shall remain nameless, moving out of the Niger Delta and going offshore. So I just see that there's a lot still happening there. There's a lot still to be resolved. But what I'm really excited about is the move more towards looking at agriculture and looking at the land. And people are starting to think about, well, what else comes out of the land? How else are we supposed to deal with what we have? And that's really more where I'm located. I'm not sort of focusing so much on oil, as it were. I'm really interested in exploring other identities and other riches that the Niger Delta has.
And do you think it's possible to begin some kind of positive narratives for the Niger Delta then? This culture that may have got lost in some of the stories that we've been told in the past years, do you think that's something that can reemerge and can help bring people together and give a new identity to the Delta?
I think it's not just about positive or negative. I don't deal in positive and negative. I deal in personal and political. So I think I'm really interested in much more nuanced readings. I want personal stories to inform the wider sense of what the Niger Delta might be about. So I'm doing a lot of projects, not just Boys Quarters. I'm doing projects for museums in America. And some of those projects also really relate to just more personal things that are going on in the villages that I know about, that I'm from, and starting to mine our identities and our cultural mores, etc., and starting to do work with that and turning that into video installation, turning that into food installations. I'm doing all sorts of things that relate to that. So I really kind of, when you say positive, I'm interested in joy. I'm interested in a more joyful reading. I'm interested in personal readings. I'm interested in readings of the place that kind of inform the imagination in much more multi-dimensional ways. It's not just, oh, let's think about oil and oil spillages. We've got to think about land. We've got to think about history or think about religion. Let's think. And also for me, I always think about pollution, not just in terms of oil. There's many forms of pollution. There's emotional, there's social, there's psychological. There are all these different ways of sort of trying to see how perhaps an oil economy impacts an individual and a culture. So, and I just think that's really rich territory for an artist to start to explore. So it's not just talking about this oil spillage happened here or this that has to happen. Those narratives are happening and will continue to happen. But I think it's really important to flesh out the identity at the same time.
You're doing this project at a really amazing moment when there's so many things going on in Nigeria. Nigeria is in the news every single day, whether it's for Boko Haram, for the kidnapped girls, for corruption, for all sorts of things. But
success
positive stories,
but so
Ebola, success with Ebola, and success also with arts and culture, with films and music and all sorts of things. When you're an artist based in Nigeria, trying to tell your stories around the world, trying to draw people into Nigeria, does that make it a complicated story to tell? People have so many impressions now of Nigeria. It's, a country in the news every single day.
No, I mean, because of that platform, because there's a news platform, I think the culture stories also have something to, to hang on to. So I think, no, it's not hard to get people interested in Nigeria. And I think the cultural industries are becoming more and more important, thank God, alongside oil. That so I'm just part of that story.
Now tell me, how can people who are not import hardcore, who want to know more about what you're doing and your ambitions, is there a way for them, is there a website, is there a way for them to digitally follow what you're up to?
Yes. Okay, so we have a lot to do in terms of our own personal website, but you can go to my website, which is zenasarawiwa.com, and it has all projects there, all my curatorial projects, etc. And we have got an Instagram account, Boys Quarters, and there is a website, boysquartersprojectspace.com. That will be sorted out by the end of the week. But if you go to my website, everything is there.
And finally, just tell me, why is this kind of cap on the project of 2 years?
Oh, it's well, originally
that's about how much time you can take before you do it.
I mean, I think it's a good start, let's say that. Okay. But I think that there's a lot of work to do, and I think it probably will go on beyond 2 years, to be honest. So,
well, thank you so much for coming to see that. That's Zenasarawiwa, and the exhibition is now open in Port Harcourt, Nigeria, if you happen to be there, and it's all about the Boys Quarters Project Space. Thank you.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam,
all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And it's time now for our daily arts review. And today we talk with The Telegraph's music journalist, Pete Norton, who's here with me in the studio. Pete, we're going to start with Circles by Kate Tempest. Yep. And perhaps we should play a little clip of this and you can tell us a little bit about her. I go round in circles.
circles. Not graceful, not like dancers. Not neatly, not like compass and pencil. More like a dog on a lead, but I'm mental. I go round in circles. Not graceful, not like dancers. Not neatly, not like compass and pencil. More like a dog on a lead, but I'm mental. I'm in the corner saying nothing. Sitting in the pub with my eyes closed. Swaying to a power.
Well, that's Kate Tempest, who's poet and musician.
Yeah, so I think she began as a rapper. She's 28 years old. She's from Broccoli in South London. So she actually began as a rapper and then kind of stumbled into poetry at a youngish age. And she was kind of critically lauded for that. She won a Ted Hughes Prize last year for a volume of poetry that she published. But she's kind of gone back to rap again through performance poetry. And this album, her album was released earlier this year and has been nominated for the Mercury.
And you think she's a good thing?
Yeah, I really do. Yeah, I mean, I heard this track kind of a couple of weeks ago on the radio, and it was the first time in a while I've had this "who is this" moment, you know, with contemporary pop, where I really think she's got a distinctive voice and style, and it's kind of between the two worlds of poetry and rap pop, if you like.
I don't know. There's something that reminds me a little bit, you know, some of the other people who came out of South London, like, you know, Miss Dynamite and all those people who had a kind of way of rapping that was close to poetry in some moments.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, people talk about Dizzy Rascal as well as having this interesting thing. He's East London. But there's something about Kate Tempest that's more interesting than that, even for me. She's got this really, like, kind of ballsy style, and she doesn't take any prisoners. And listening to her album, she's got a lot of, you know, she's got a lot of beef with the industry as it is, and which I just think is refreshing to have that voice.
And it's interesting because actually 28 is, for the music industry, almost kind of getting to the point where you need to kind of make it or not. So she's obviously been plugging away at this in different directions for quite some time, which is, I guess, makes it a bit more of a rich experience as well.
Yeah, and I think it was a surprise. You know, she was nominated for the Mercury, which has given this a big boost, and I think it's got it more radio play. And that was a surprise to her, I think. But it's great. I mean, I think it's a really bold choice.
Okay, so your second choice is Jose Gonzalez. And who's this?
Jose Gonzalez is, I think, a Swedish-American singer-songwriter guitarist who's popular in his own right. But this song is taken from a forthcoming, it's actually just released today, a compilation of cover versions of music by Arthur Russell, who's an American composer and singer-songwriter and cellist, who was incredibly influential and incredibly talented and creative, but kind of died relatively unknown in 1992 of AIDS, and has been always regarded as a hero by members of by musicians, largely, but is now kind of, I think, coming more to a wider audience. And this cover album is kind of a part of that.
Well, let's have a listen.
Jump over. Every step is
pulling
me off.
So tell me, is this a kind of the estate? His estate? How does something like this resurface? Is there someone, a producer, who just finds an old track? Or what's happening here that suddenly, you know, a musician like Arthur Russell kind of comes back into the fold?
Well, I think he's been in the ferment for a long time. I'm not actually sure of the exact story of this album. And how that's come about. But I mean, you hear him name checked a lot by other musicians and covered as well. But I think it's just that there's such a swell of it now. I mean, the music is just so good. Arthur Russell's music is really wonderful. I hope this album would make people go and revisit that, because it's a wonderful oeuvre.
Brilliant. Well, the final song that you've chosen for us is Guilty as a Saint, and this is by Chuck Prophet. And again, give us a bit of an introduction before we hear that.
So Chuck Prophet, I mean, kind of personal disclaimer, he's one of my real musical heroes, so I was glad to be able to fit him in, because he's just had an album out. But he's a Californian guitarist. I think he's in his 50s now, but he's been going for 30 years. And he originally played in a band called Green on Red in the 80s, and then went solo after that, I think, in the 90s. And he is just one of the great guitarists for me. He's weirdly under-recognized or under-popular, but he's a Keith Richards-esque gift for a riff, but he can also solo like a demon, and but he's very witty. His lyrics are very witty, and I just think he's great.
Let's hear him.
Well, one day the light fell on my face. I began to moan. 6 billion people in the world, and I sleep alone. Guilty as a saint.
And why do you think, you know, here's obviously someone, again, with huge talent who you admire, who all the musicians admire. Why is it that they stay a little bit under the radar? Is it just they just don't have that kind of desire to commercialize their music enough? Is it that these days you don't get the breaks unless you're kind of more like a pop act?
That's a very interesting question, and not one that I have a full answer to, I would say. But I mean, I think he's plowing a furrow that isn't particularly trendy right now. It's kind of rock and roll, I went to a gig of his last week in Shepherd's Bush, and the audience was, I'd say, 95% middle-aged man. There's nothing wrong with that. But as in terms of the market for his music, perhaps it's a shrinking thing. And he's not the Stones. He's not of that kind of level of fame and popularity.
But I guess what was interesting is all three tracks, there's a kind of references to the past and reference to the future. There's a kind of a richness of how these people are putting their tracks together, which is a kind of surprising, kind of liberating in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think we do live in a great era for music at the moment. As much as people bemoan the state of pop and all the rest of it, I think there's an enormous amount of creativity out there, especially on the margins.
Well, Pete, thank you very much for coming to see us. That's the music journalist Pete Norton, who's from The Telegraph. Thank you
very much.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Now, we just have time to turn to some sad news out of the fashion industry, which is the death has been announced of Oscar de la Renta, the iconic American designer who died of cancer complications at the age of 82. And joining us to tell us about his life and his legacy is Monocle's luxury expert, Sagra Mathia de Rosa. Now, Sagra, he was the American designer in many senses. You know, he made Jackie Kennedy look how she was. He kind of dressed the American woman. He'd been to Paris. He came back to America. What was his greatness about, do you think?
Well, I think he was a true gentleman. I actually had the pleasure to meet him a few times. And it just embodies true elegance and grace and, you know, know-how and craft in a way that... it was a real example for all the American designers behind him, that come behind him.
And lots of very powerful women in politics and business like to wear his clothes. But that's
everybody. Everybody.
But there's something about it, I guess, that is, you know, it wasn't old Europe, was it? There was something quite American about it.
Yeah, I think it was a mix. I mean, he, as you know, he was born in the Dominican Republic. So it was a very, I think his kind of Latin... roots also were very important in his aesthetics, because he was very much about color and about print and flowers, and I think that a lot came from the Latin American background. And he was still very connected to the Dominican Republic. He had a house there, which was in a way part of his lifestyle. Like, his boutiques around the world really reflected a little bit the Latin American background. But he was really quintessentially, I would say, Park Avenue, Upper East Side, lady, New York lady, or kind of American lady. But you know what was interesting, I thought? It really transcended ages, because he also had really, really young customers, especially in the latter years. You would see all the kind of super young actresses wearing Oscar de la Renta. Anybody who's anybody getting married will wear Oscar de la Renta. So it was a real aspiration for many people.
A very sophisticated kind of glamour. And just finally, he was also interesting because he was, you know, not your typical fashion designer. He was kind of a man's man as well. You know, he played cards with Warren Buffett. You know, he married several times. He was quite a playboy as well.
Well, I mean, I think he had like two or three very long established marriages. I'm not sure of playboy,
but well, I mean,
he was like a real charmer. Both men and women loved him.
Okay, well, thank you, Sagra, so much for coming in. I'm afraid we didn't have a huge amount of time to pick over his life. But it was great to speak to you about the death today of Oscar De La Renta. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests at the top of the show, Alessio Patilano and Zenya Wickett. Today's show was produced by Emily Elias, researched by David Pleasant and Muriel Kawagi. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next, after me, it's Section D.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.